Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, the men of Magic Mike, or at least some of them, are back for, what else, Magic Mike XXL, a movie with plenty of grinding, plenty of bumping, and plenty of Channing Tatum. The adult themes continue as we look next at Amazon's Catastrophe, a comedy about love, pregnancy, and work visas. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture every week. Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under podcasts.
It's a big show for grown-ups this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us for a second week in a row, could we be any luckier? Our friend and the person we have subjected to Magic Mike XXL, even though she is such a sweet girl at heart, our librarian pal, Margaret H. Willison. Hi, Margaret.
Are you there, Linda?
It's me, Margaret.
It's true. I know you missed that last week.
And I
you
did.
Were terribly,
you should have done last week.
I was terribly so
sad.
Embarrassed.
This is why it's so good to get a second week in a row. So, Margaret, if you're not familiar with her other work, is a librarian, and as she always says, for love and money, she's a librarian, and just for love, she's a lovely Twitter personality and half of the team that puts out the Two Bossy Dames newsletter.
You said that better than I could.
Well, what can I tell you? I've done it a million times. So the first thing on the docket this week is, everything that comes out of my mouth is going to sound slightly dirty while we have this conversation.
Yep.
And that is a good time to point out. You know, this episode, both Magic Mike XXL and Catastrophe are adult-themed. They may contain, you know, we still are the people we are. We try to be a family podcast. But, you know, there's only so much you can say. You got to say stripper. You got to say pregnant lady and talk about how that might happen. So,
I don't know. I got the vapors just hearing you say these words.
So if you were feeling like, it's not so much if you're listening with your children, but if you're listening with your parents,
yes.
You know,
sure,
maybe think twice. Magic Mike XXL is the sequel to Magic Mike, the classic. Magic Mike classic.
Magic Mike Zero.
The Turner Home Movies classic.
And, OG Magic Mike.
Right, exactly. And Magic Mike, the 2012 original, was directed by Steven Soderbergh and written by Reed Carolyn. And this sequel is not a Soderbergh film, which made a lot of people very nervous, but it is still the same writer. And the director, Gregory Jacobs, has been Soderbergh's AD, assistant director, on a bunch of things going all the way back to, like, Out of Sight.
And Soderbergh works, like, on... He does a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff.
But it is definitely not a pass-off to a total stranger.
Right.
So kind of the sense of, would this still be a fun movie for people who thought Magic Mike was a fun movie is maybe, you know, a little overstated. But if you did not see Magic Mike, the basic point of Magic Mike was there was a guy... whose name is Mike.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
Yeah. Right. Go on.
Played by Channing Tatum, who was part of a troupe of male strippers called the Kings of Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first movie, he was working for a guy played by Matthew McConaughey, who was kind of the MC and the leader of the group and ran the whole thing, and was also indoctrinating a kid played by Alex Pettifer. And one of the first things that happens in this movie is they announce all the people who aren't in it.
Yep.
They start off by saying, Dallas, that's the Matthew McConaughey character. Dallas is gone. He took the kid with him. That's the Pettifer character. And also you realize very quickly that you're not going to see the girl who Mike wound up with at the end of the first movie.
I think they should have had a cast list and just had a line drawn through the three.
It's true. And I think, for me, the beginning of this movie is kind of the clunkiest as they're trying to set up, you know, why are you going to revisit these guys? Because the entire point of Magic Mike, if you can say it had a point to it, is at the end, Mike decides to leave the world of stripping and go off with his girlfriend. And they're all going to go on without him. The kid is going to stay with Dallas and the rest of the guys are all going to go. So now you've got to kind of figure out how to shoehorn, as it were, Mike back into the Kings of Tampa.
Uh-huh.
What do you think, Glenn?
You know, this is a very genial movie. This is a very goofy movie. So the scene everybody's going to be talking about this weekend is the scene with Joe Manganiello going into the convenience store.
Right, right.
Where he proceeds to do a performance for the clerk. The secret of this movie, the puzzle that I've solved, and it's not a particularly hard puzzle, it's more a TV Guide crossword puzzle. It's a seek and find, really. The secret of this movie is he doesn't want to turn her on. He wants to make her smile.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's why this film doesn't feel to me particularly sexy. The stripping is pantomime. It's bigger. It's goofier. There's a lot of grinding, as you say, and there's a lot of crotches in people's faces. And sometimes it gets a little, you know, faux violent with some of the women who are participating.
Mm-hmm.
But it never feels creepy because it is very, very genial. Here's a hot take. You ready for a hot take? Matt Bomer, an attractive man.
He is. It's a rare opinion.
He is carved from the finest Carrara marble, this guy.
Yeah.
His facial symmetry is frankly disquieting.
Yeah.
I kind of had to keep looking away from it.
I think when he...
Because he's like, I kept thinking something was going to go wrong because he's like a hot basilisk. He can't stare. You must avoid his gaze. He's like staring into the sun if the sun had a perfect nose.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think when he first came on in this movie, I actually kind of heard myself go, there are disquietingly good looking dudes all over this movie. Not two of one. But
good looking dudes abound.
It's
shirts,
true. Not so much,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, what did you think, Margaret?
I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I was not expecting to come out just exuberantly in favor, but the second I left the theater, I opened up my phone and I texted the group of women I refer to as my coven and started making plans to see it over the long weekend because it's just that kind of film.
Nice.
The first movie, I liked Channing Tatum's performance. I liked being taken by surprise by how charismatic he was. But the judgy girlfriend really did not do it for me. And the commitment to being very dour about the life they were leading, I totally understood and respected, but it kind of was at odds with what I was there to see in the movie.
Mm-hmm. It goes for a little more indiness, a little more self-conscious indiness in the first one for sure, whereas this one is much more over the top.
Yeah, this one had a better idea that I wanted to go and see it with the group of women I referred to as my coven.
Right. Exactly. No, I think that's the right plan. How about you, Thompson? What did you think?
Well, we all sat together and saw this movie in one big row, and to my left is my pop culture happy hour people, and to my right is my girlfriend Katie. When the movie was over, Katie leaned over to me and said, "That was important."
And I
laughed out loud. You can definitely say, like, there are statements being made in this movie, but this is also just a wonderfully silly, goofy movie. I mean, it didn't feel like a sequel so much as a victory lap.
I think that's right.
It's essentially...
Lap.
Nice. It's set up as, you know, like, you know, one last big score. They're going out on
a road trip,
and they're gonna go to the stripper convention. But like, there's not even like a contest they have to win.
Right.
There's not even like there's nobody they have to like. I was gonna say stick it in their faces.
It's like the Karate Kid if the end was just an exhibition.
Yeah, it's like the Karate Kid if like they all went and had a good time.
Guys,
yeah,
it's strip it on.
No stakes. No
there
stakes.
There are zero stakes. There is no tension. There are things that go wrong, complications, like they need a different vehicle to get to the stripper convention.
Yeah, their artisan froyo van freaks out.
There's no tension. And in a way, like, that felt novel to me. Like, it's just so fun and silly, and it definitely accelerates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It starts a little slow. It starts a little like, where are they going with this? Do I care necessarily about these people? Mm. It's a little bit like Pitch Perfect in that it comes alive in these big, lavish, ridiculous performances.
Right.
But it's just such a fun movie, and it's really enlivened by the fact, like, I thought of it as like, this is like Entourage if they actually enjoyed women.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's right.
Or Pitch Perfect 2 if it was a little less racist.
Yeah.
Well, that's
the thing. The first Magic Mike movie posited a world in which there were no gay people and no black people.
Mm-hmm.
And they've course corrected slightly. There's a whole visitation to a strip club, a strip...
It's
mention?
sort of a stripping brothel is what I referred to it as. It's more structured like a brothel. It's run by Jada Pinkett. She is the kind of MC of this private strip club where kind of you go with your friends. And it is an interesting dynamic because I think that is an establishment that's entirely, the clientele is pretty much entirely black women. And the strippers are pretty much black men. And when she kind of then becomes part of their traveling show, they wind up kind of transplanting the things she does to this kind of convention center audience of largely white women. And there is a something about that that is interesting to contemplate.
Right.
At least they bring her. They don't just bring the idea of the stuff she does. But it's interesting to watch kind of how that happens and how they play with that. The thing I didn't care for as much, there's an earlier sequence before they meet up with her where they're in a drag club. Mm-hmm. They're basically at a drag show. First of all, I think the idea that all these drag folk would be so impressed by them was a little
implausible.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's not drag. Like, what they're doing is male stripping. It's not drag. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily lend itself.
They often accompany drag queens.
Right, but do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's not the same thing, and it's not, drag culture is a separate, is its own separate thing.
Yeah, but I was that sequence I also paid a lot of attention to for various reasons. But the reason it's such a fantasy is that, in my experience, this much full-throated broiness that's on display in this film is very rarely accompanied by a complete lack of homophobia. Mm-hmm. And that's what this film espouses.
That's interesting.
There are scenes where two dudes have to share a hotel bed and nothing is made of it. Absolutely nothing.
That's really interesting.
There is not even a joke about it. It's just, and they express their love for each other over and over again. It's in nature. I don't think this algorithm exists, but in the movie it certainly did.
And likewise, a complete lack of misogyny.
I mean,
you get to see women of many different races, all sizes, enjoying themselves, experiencing, you know, some lusty feelings, and they're never the butt of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
It's never like, oh, look at these dopes salivating.
No,
they're celebrated. They're very central to the experience. You're told over and over again they're queens. It's really refreshing.
Yeah, I felt that way too.
And so refreshing.
I think it has a really interesting relationship to the women who are in it and the women who are going to these shows, because this movie posits that whereas if you see a movie about men going to see stripping, it will either be treated as something that's kind of degrading or it will be treated as something at the very least where the men are like very turned on by it or very kind of amped up by it. What you will not see is female strippers presented as something that men go to see because they're hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And there is a strong undercurrent in this movie of the idea that part of the reason that straight women go to see male strippers is that they find it funny. It makes them laugh. They're laughing the whole time.
Yeah.
And then there is a really interesting conversation that takes place between a couple of the guys who have kind of been in this business, where one of them is pointing out, like, what women like about this experience, or part of what women like about this experience, is people actually care what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people actually ask them what they want and want to do whatever they want and want to make them happy. And so he's kind of saying it's so easy to make them happy because all you have to do is care what they want.
Right.
And so, and that, it's not said in a mean way.
Right.
It's it's not said in like a, oh, I really get them. I just act like I care what they want. He's saying, like, it is incredible how the women who come to this establishment have been set up to feel like it's a big deal for someone to even care what you want. I'm not trying to like super analyze the movie. It is a very silly movie, and it's comedic and it's funny, but it's always interesting to me to think, how are they building this world? And I think there's more attention here than there was in the first movie on the relationship between the audience and the people who are doing the dancing, stripping, whatever.
You really can't underplay like how important it is that these dudes like fundamentally like women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that how much of the heavy lifting just comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And like how much of them as entertainers comes from that. They encounter several situations in which they're just hanging out with women.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy McDowell comes in and has this
so good.
This big, you know, this very big, delightful, goofy performance. But like along the way, it's just the power balance there is very even. Like these people all just like each other. And that's part of what makes this movie feel very good natured and makes things like a plot or any kind of conflict largely unnecessary.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's true in real life
that interactions between male strippers and audiences are as win-win as the interactions in this movie are. But that is certainly what they suggest in this movie.
And that's a big difference from the first movie, where you sort of get two main female characters, and one enjoys the stripping world, but in a very predatory sort of way. Mm-hmm. And the other one is kind of puritanically separate from it.
Right.
And is just
and doesn't approve.
And right. And it's just sullen.
Right.
Yeah. And that Andy McDowell scene could have been a cougar joke, an extended cougar joke.
Right.
It flirts with it, but it gives her, makes us see that she is in on the joke. That's mm-hmm. hugely important.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it's a movie that I certainly don't think you'd want to sit around and parse every beat of it,
right.
Because I don't think it would hold up that well. I think every movie like this is shot through with all these assumptions that if you actually went through and kind of took them apart, like they're assuming here that this is true and this is true and this is true, it wouldn't hold up very well. It's not a movie that's intended to be kind of disassembled
to be,
to be disassembled at that level. There were times during this movie where I thought they're playing around with a lot of things, and I'm not sure if they have terribly interesting ideas about those things, but they're playing around with them. There's a kind of a big sequence where there's a bunch of different stripping kind of performances going on, and there is a sense that the point of all these performances is that the women in the audience are into a lot of different things. Some mm-hmm. of them are into kind of a more aggressive thing. Some of them are into a more kind of romantic thing. Some of them are into a kind of a, you know, Sinatra-esque crooning thing. Some of them are hot for the idea of bride and groom, you know, cosplay. And it's interesting in that way. It's not like every woman wants to see the same thing with chaps and all that.
Yep.
It's just, it's a bunch of different stuff.
Even though it is in many ways a small movie, it's not necessarily a wait for basic cable. It's a see it opening night with a bunch of rowdy goobers.
Take a bunch of rowdy goobers with you. I
yes.
agree. When I was watching Channing Tatum in this movie, I thought about Gene Kelly, which is
yeah.
for me, like the magnitude of that compliment coming from me is pretty serious. But it's because so much of the acting is bound up in the physicality, and Gene Kelly was the same way. And I think that they take a scene where he is dancing by himself, and it is so much fun, and it's so goofy. It's also really impressive, and it's so over the top that it has a kind of a sense of humor about what it's doing.
Anytime you pipe in the opening strains of Pony, I'm just in. Every scene would be better with Pony in it.
Well, we enjoyed Magic Mike XXL, as you can tell, and I'll be interested to hear whether you guys enjoy it, too. You can come and find us on Facebook or on Twitter at NPRPCHH or on the blog at npr.org and let us know what you thought. When we come back, we're going to talk about the comedy Catastrophe, which has appeared on Amazon in the last couple of weeks, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Barb, and I'm calling from Missouri. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message are from TastingRoom.com, the only wine club that fits your personal tastes. Here's how it works. Tasting Room sends you a kit with sample-sized bottles of wine. You sip each one, log on to their site, and tell them which wines you liked. Tasting Room then picks wines for you based on your tastes. You get your first full case right after you tell them what you like, and you get new cases of wine every 3 months. Visit TastingRoom.com/NPR for the wine club where your taste is the only one that matters.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are now going to talk a little bit, you know, the first part was about the sexy male strippers, and now we're going to talk a little bit about sexy grown-ups in an actual relationship. Amazon recently dropped the six episodes of a comedy called Catastrophe, which aired on television in the UK. It stars Rob Delaney, who you might know from Twitter, and Sharon Horgan, who's an actress, and...
Yeah.
They play a couple where he is an American and he goes to London and they meet and they have kind of a, what would you call it?
Like a tryst.
Goofy
a
affair.
Six,
but it's like a
tryst.
Yeah, it's like a goofy affair over a period of like a week. And then she gets pregnant. And the six episodes of the first season basically follow them over the time that she's pregnant. I have already talked about this show and why I like it. So I'm going to start with Stephen, actually. What did you think, Stephen?
There's a great scene early on that to me sums up so much of what I like about this show. They are suddenly having to be a serious couple. They are suddenly living together. They are suddenly like... They've skipped all these courtship steps, and so they're suddenly just sharing this tiny apartment. And there's this wonderful scene where she is, like, lying in bed, and she just sends him out. She's just like, I need you to go out, go for a walk. He thinks she's like asking him to go for a walk together. And she's like, no, I just need you to go. Mm-hmm. I need you to like walk around for like just like a half a day. Mm-hmm. It's just this great moment where she's not being mean.
She doesn't not like him.
She doesn't not like him. Mm-hmm. But like she is very accustomed to having this space to herself and like just needs him to get the hell out of her place for a while. And there are just these just tons of details like that about how people are. And none of their experiences are without complication. None of their experiences are necessarily going particularly smoothly. Their lives are being massively disrupted and they don't skirt those issues. Their relationship isn't yet fully formed, but they're very quickly fully formed characters. Mm-hmm. And they crack each other up a lot. You know, they make a lot of jokes that caused the characters to laugh. And you pick up very quickly, like, he kind of barrels ahead. He's a kind of a can-do optimist. And he's like, we can do this. We'll just make this work. Mm-hmm. And she's doubting every single step of the way. And, like, neither one of them is necessarily wrong. Mm-hmm. In the way that they're going about it. I like this show a lot. I also just find them charming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They clearly are writing the show. They're slipping bits of themselves into their characters. And I like them as actors. I seem to like them as people.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, how about you, Glenn? What do you think?
I think of this as a sitcom for people who hate sitcoms. if you hate that set up punchline. And this notion that jokes sort of descend from on high and everybody can make them and then nobody laughs at them. Mm-hmm. That's a very important point you said, Stephen, where it's like when somebody says something funny, you laugh at it. They're in this honeymoon phase, and yet they've already fast-forwarded, as you said, Stephen, to 10 years, like a long-term relationship. What's really smart is that they're learning each other. They're learning, for example, how to fight. You can see in scenes where they're fighting, neither one of them knows how far is too far to go, so they're negotiating it. I don't know this actress, Sharon Horgan. I'd never seen her before, but I didn't see her show Pulling, which she did over there. But she is quickly becoming my favorite actress and my favorite character on TV right now. Mm-hmm. There is a guardedness to her performance that is allowed to fracture and allowed to let this big galoot in.
I thought of the word galoot about 75 times.
He really sees. Like, I love joke density, but this show isn't about the jokes because there is no lunging for the jokes. This isn't a sweaty show at all. They find them. They emerge from character, and that's why it feels different. That's why it feels so refreshing.
Yeah. How about you, Margaret?
I love this show. I watched all 6 episodes because we sort of discussed that was what we were going to do, and I was really reluctant to do it because, like you said last week, I wanted to savor it. And I think it's a really interesting sort of step in romantic comedy as a genre. It's very similar in plot to the Judd Apatow movie Knocked Up, where it's like 2 strangers decide to have a baby together. And I can think of that
movie. And one of them is a galoot.
And you can think of that movie as kind of a proof of concept. Mm-hmm. It's like you can marry this sort of bro-centric, gross-out humor mm-hmm. with a very sweet love story. But that movie understood what would bind boys to their male friends, but it didn't really seem to get what would bring a couple together. Mm-hmm.
That's what you really see
in this, and you really see it, I think, in part because it's co-written by the 2 lead comics, one of whom is a woman. One of the great scenes very early on in episode 2 that demonstrated just the vital importance of having a female voice contributing to the script is an exchange that Sharon has with her best friend, who's also a teacher at this primary school, about why on earth she wants to get married. And the teacher is like, the 2000s, like, you don't have to do this. And they have a very sexually frank but not gross exchange back and forth that ends in her best friend just belting out a throaty cackle, which is my lifeblood.
Right.
And it's just like those kind of exchanges, those kind of authentic exchanges that happen between women when men aren't necessarily there is what makes this show so strong.
Yeah. And I like the comparison that you made to Knocked Up, because I think one of the things that's so different about that and this, despite the fact that the setup is kind of similar, the people in Knocked Up, what you're seeing in Knocked Up is people who are very immature, forced to grow up, especially mm-hmm. him.
Yes.
Rob Delaney in this show is not playing a man child. He is playing a fully grown adult dude. And she is playing a fully grown adult woman. Nobody is standing there being like, oh no, a baby, what will I do? I'll have to stop going out with my friends. Like, that's not their response to this. Their response to this has this incredible kind of humanity to it, where they find themselves in this situation, they decide what they're going to do. There is a combination of kind of old relationship and new relationship, because they're still kind of at the beginning of getting to know each other, but they've already committed in a way. And so there's such an interesting mix of it's like somebody you've been dating forever, but it's also like somebody that you're on your fourth date with. And so I love the fact that they are intelligent about this from the beginning.
Right.
You know, not every single thing they do is a great idea necessarily, but they are thoughtful about it from the beginning. And I think that as the show goes on, you know, they deal with some of what it's like to be pregnant when you're a little bit older, as she is, because you have to kind of go through different kinds of tests and figure out what's going on a little in a little different way. And the doctor makes you nervous all the time. There's some really good material, I think, with the doctor and with them just hating going to the doctor, because every time they go to the doctor, it's something that freaks them out completely. Yep. And they
and just upends their lives.
And just upends their lives and makes them panic all over again, which I think no matter what age you are and no matter what kind of relationship you're in, there's some of that. The thing that I think is so cool about it is, as a person who watches a lot of romantic comedy, it's really hard to make romantic comedy that is kind of crackly and bubbly and vibrant that doesn't come out of artificially pumped up conflict. But, there are a couple of moments in this where they start you down the road to a very standard romantic comedy conflict, and then all of a sudden all the air goes out of it because it turns out that's not what's going on. And it's almost like there's this, ha-ha, you forgot these are adults. You know? They, in fact, you forgot these are grown adults.
They, like, prank each other.
Right, exactly. They they prank each other by, you know, I'm going to fall. We're going to go down this rabbit hole of the kind of thing that you expect to go wrong.
Yeah. I don't begrudge the show's focus on the couple. That's what makes the show the show. That said, around the periphery, there are some supporting characters who aren't really fleshed out yet. It's the first season. It's only six episodes. And they are getting a second season. So I'm glad that we're going to hopefully get a little bit more something to his D-bag friend. Kind of just one note.
Who's just the person he knows in London.
But I mean, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But it's still, that character is, he's not interesting annoying. He's just annoying. Ashley Jensen, a fantastic actress from the best part of Ricky Gervais's Extras, plays this character, Fran, who is her friend that she hates. Her very, very close friend that she cannot stand. And you just need more with her. And Carrie Fisher plays his mom in like a scene. In like 30 seconds on the phone.
But she's so good in those 30 seconds.
She's so funny, though.
Consistently so good.
And you really get a sense that Carrie, you know, Carrie Fisher's been tweeting her enthusiasm for this show, but you really get a sense that, like, she's had no involvement in the show. Like, they just went to her her apartment and shot these scenes, because she's always just
on, French bulldog.
She's on the phone.
She's always just on the phone, so you never actually see her having to be in the room with anyone on the show, and yet she's so good, and she brings this Carrie Fisher gravitas, awful, like this, oh, she's such an awful person. not Carrie Fisher herself,
no,
but the character she's playing. I do want to talk about how much I love Rob Delaney, and I had only really experienced him. I have not really spent any time with his stand-up. He's pretty new to me as an actual physical presence. Like, I knew he was a big guy. You know, he's got a little bit of like a Will Ferrell presence. But he
a little more classically good looking than Will Ferrell.
I was about to say, a little handsomer.
He's a brawny paper towel man. He's a handsome fella.
His brawny paper towel man thing, as Margaret says, is something that he's very good about kind of keeping on the down low. It's not really part of his persona, and yet it's like so true. I think stand up comedians are not really supposed to be handsome.
Well, yeah, and he's like, and he's constantly undercutting with this kind of oafishness, or you see his bare butt, you know, he's just kind of, you know, his pants are always falling down around his ankles in some ways. But he also has, as a comic actor, what I call Bob Odenkirk syndrome, which is he's so funny when he swears. And I could listen to either of those guys. I could listen to Rob Delaney swear all day long.
Well, then you should watch any of his stand-ups. Yeah, it is really hysterical and enjoyable and full of jokes and full of good, kind of full of good cheer in that way. It's also in a couple of places just really romantic. Like, yeah. There are some moments in this where you get that little bit of, like, what that feels like when somebody's just awesome. And when you're just sitting there being like, this person is so awesome. And it's in these moments that are kind of unexpected, where you're not really sure where the conversation is going. And then all of a sudden you realize that they're just having one of these kind of magical floating moments. And they're very good at conveying that, I think.
Yeah. Yes. And one of the things that I also really appreciate about it is sort of an aspect of attraction that I spend a lot of time talking about on Twitter, which is that attraction is very specific. It's not like the crowdsourced hottest woman will always end up with the crowdsourced hottest man.
Right.
And unless you're those two distinct individuals, you know, however far you fall from that ideal, that's how likely or unlikely you are to find romantic success.
Right.
And this is very oriented around the fact that attraction is extremely specific to two people.
Mm-hmm.
She spends a certain amount of time, Sharon, comparing herself to a very attractive ex-girlfriend that he has. And they don't get into it directly, but there's a certain point where he just talks about how thoroughly he enjoys being with Sharon, specifically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How potent his attraction to her is.
This is that some of that romantic stuff I was talking
about. Yeah, exactly.
That's a very romantic scene.
Incredibly romantic
scene. Very, very romantic scene.
Yeah. Linda and I were just lying on the couch holding our brawny paper towel rolls, watching that.
Hula Hoop and I were just
real keen attention.
We were hugging our rolls of brawny paper towels.
Wrapped in the flannel shirts we'd bought from L.L. Bean.
Glenn's like, you ruined it for me.
It is, though. It's so, I mean, I always say that, like, the most underrated human emotion is liking someone.
Mm-hmm.
They really capture how important it is that these two people would like each other.
Right.
And do like each other.
You don't look at these people and think either, how would they ever have a problem?
Right.
Or why would they ever hang out together?
Right.
Yeah. You get the sense, like, this is the making of a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, like, that's what you want your couplehood to be. You want your couplehood to be a team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they are, and as much as they have conflict with each other, they're forming into a formidable team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We really like this show. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So we will be right back.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture every week. Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Three random small things. One, this is episode number 250.
250.
Of Pop Culture Happy Hour. We did not acquire a sheet cake.
Nope.
So I'm taking a single Dorito and scrawling with a Sharpie the number 250.
That is including small batches?
250 of the full weekly episodes. Obviously, we are also coming up on our 5-year anniversary, which I'm sure we will also congratulate ourselves for
in just a
few weeks. But happy 250. Thank you to everyone who listens. Another like minor milestone. We are at about the halfway point in the year, and NPR Music just put up its best of the year so far. Not only the 25 albums, but another one of those big, like 200 song mixtape app type things that are such catnip for
me
for Margaret H. Willison and her ilk. It's a lot of fun. An enormous amount of work went into it. I highly recommend it. And finally, just randomly came across a big, long profile of Carrot Top from a few months ago in Esquire magazine.
Yeah.
The headline is Carrot Top in Exile. Mm-hmm. It's by Chris Jones. It is a very warm, in-depth profile of the life of Scott Thompson, aka Carrot Top, in Las Vegas, where he makes a fortune.
Uh-huh.
It's very aware of him. Like, it's very aware of what people say about him.
Sure.
It's never laughing at him. It's just a very thorough, complex, interesting, compulsively readable portrait of Carrot Top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love that kind of interview. I love, you know, a big long read profile of somebody who's more interesting than you might think.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I didn't consume a lot of culture this weekend. It was kind of a busy weekend, kind of a big weekend. Consumed a lot of champagne, not a lot of culture. So I'm going to go back and talk about a podcast I've been listening to for years. It's called Stop Podcasting Yourself with Dave Shumka and Graham Clark, two Canadian comedians. They always have a guest. They're from Vancouver. The format is the format. It's two dudes sitting around talking about nothing with a guest. But, you know, in the podcasting medium, consistency for something that's so amorphous and so loose is tough. There has never been an episode I haven't enjoyed. I have never hit the 15-second button once while listening to this podcast. It is so naturally and easily and breezily funny. It's not that they're bro-y at all. They're not. And they're not, you know, self-consciously nerdy. They're right there in the middle. They're just guys hanging out who like each other and are funny. So that is Stop Podcasting Yourself. It's part of the Jesse Thorniverse.
Ah, Jesse Thorniverse. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Margaret H. Hula Hoop Wilson, what is making you happy this week?
Other than that nickname, I brought three things to the table. Breaking with tradition, I also want to recommend a podcast. Mm-hmm. In this case, it is the JV Club with Janet Varney. Mm-hmm. I am someone who is really close friends with a lot of people from high school still, and I always take care to note, but not in a sad way. And that means we spend a lot of time talking about what we did in high school, not in a sad way. And I've discovered that I'm not a terrible person because I also really enjoy hearing other people talk about what they did in high school.
Right.
And that is sort of the conceit of the JV Club, which is she brings on comedians, frequently female comedians, and just goes deep with them about what kind of person they were when they were a teenager. So if you've ever wondered what June Diane Raphael feels about Anne of Green Gables, which, I mean,
like, who hasn't?
This is the podcast for you. I adore it. And my best friend from high school is the one who got me into it. And then I wanted to recommend two newsletters. So I write a newsletter, and therefore I spend a lot of time with them, trying to figure out which ones are good and which ones aren't. And there were two particularly I thought people for Pop Culture Happy Hour would love. So one is called So What? Who Cares? Mm-hmm. And that's written by Lisa Schmeiser.
Lisa Schmeiser is an old Television Without Pity recapper.
Ah, no wonder it is so good. Mm-hmm. I feel like to the modern media landscape, Television Without Pity is what, like, the Algonquin Round Table was.
That's very kind of you, Margaret.
And her newsletter is terrific. It's basically what you would get if you crossed Planet Money with Pop Culture Happy Hour and turned it into a newsletter. It is fascinating and funny and full of information you would not, if you're me, consume any other way, but you will always be happy to have in your arsenal of facts and news. And then the other one is called Weird Personal Emails by Liz Galvao. She is a comedy writer and a music writer. And this is a very sort of formless thing. She just writes about what's on her mind once a week. She just happens to be funnier and smarter and more interesting than most people in terms of what's on her mind. It's just a joy to visit with every single week. So those are two newsletters. You can find them through Tiny Letter, and they are both exceptional, and I think you guys would really enjoy them.
Thank you very much, Margaret Willison. I got a couple of things. Some of you may have heard that the President of the United States sat down with Mark Maron for WTF as we taped this a week ago. I think that although that is a very interesting podcast, I would more highly recommend the one after that.
I was going to say that.
Where it was Maron and his producer talking about the process. At first, I thought it was going to be just the logistics of like setting up an interview with the president. And there is some of that. They talk about just how long ago they started having these conversations, which if you think they suddenly decided that it was respectable to do a podcast after Serial happened, you are wrong, because it goes much farther back than that. Wow. And so they talk about that. But more than that, it's this story of the producer handling Maron handling Mark Maron's predictably self-defeating attitude toward interviewing the president, which you would think it would be like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the biggest thing to ever happen to my little podcast. I think that's what we would think. But instead, of course, because he's Mark Maron, he went through this bizarre series of neurotic, self-defeating circular arguments in his own head, and you get the story of the hero producer kind of figuring out how to handle this guy. And I think that those of us who make podcasts do our best to be low maintenance and not require tons and tons of handling. But you realize that even if you try to be a person who requires no handling, you probably require a little bit of handling. Hopefully not as much as freaking out Marc Maron. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, the last couple few weeks in the news have been really complicated. And I think for everybody, some mix of highs and lows and who knows and whatever. And I am a bit out of the habit of watching The Daily Show, and Colbert isn't on anymore. My great joy in the last 3 weeks or so has been really doubling down with watching Larry Wilmore and John Oliver. Larry Wilmore's The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, and John Oliver's Last Week Tonight on HBO on Sundays. The thing that I think is setting these shows apart right now is that The Daily Show and Colbert had really devoted themselves almost exclusively by, you know, the last couple of years to mocking media, right? So as critical as it was, all you ever got was, look at these dummies on CNN, look at these dummies on Fox, look at these dummies on MSNBC. And I think that Wilmore and Oliver are both more willing to say, it's not just the reporting that you're getting, and it's not just the TV that you're watching. It's also the way people think, and the way people don't think, and the way people don't read, and the way people hold certain prejudices, and the way that people approach problems. I find it refreshing. They both do tons and tons of media criticism, but they also are willing to say, people holding this prejudice, that's problematic. People not wanting to listen to this point of view is problematic. So they're both, to me, casting a wider net, and I think it's been really, really cool. The Nightly Show and Last Week Tonight right now are, to me, just doing excellent, excellent work, and they're both really essential. And as sad as I am about Jon Stewart leaving The Daily Show, it's nice to be watching both of those shows and feel like we're in good hands already. So those are the things that are making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. That's MrsFridayNext. Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. And helping out Jessica this week is Kiana Fitzgerald. You can follow Kiana at Kiana Fitz. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.